This morning we're going to finish Thessalonians, a short letter that we could read in about 15 minutes on Sunday morning. We've been in for probably about 9 months when it all comes to it. But we will finish it this morning, and then I'm going to next week lay a foundation for 1 Corinthians, which is actually a really difficult book because it's full of all sorts of problems that the Corinthian churches got into before they and really got themselves almost in a position where they were willing to abandon Paul and not stay with the faith. But some of the more complicated problems that they ran into produce a lot of controversy and are problems that are very, very characteristic of our churches today. The divisions, it parallels not only individual churches that aren't established, but also the whole denominational divisional mess that we're in that almost completely incapacitates the evangelical church today from being able to have impact in the cultures. You've got a sheet in front of you. We're going to go into discussion in just a moment, but I want to give an introduction that really I couldn't have given before this last 30 days. And I was kind of feeling, right before I left, there were a lot of pressures, and so I was not really in a position to be able to do this last message. And so I wanted the symmetry there. I wanted to give you the research to start working on Corinthians. And so it was a little bit discouraging, but now after being on this trip and knowing how this introduction really fits in to this last chapter, or this session 5 of the Thessalonians book, it makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't have had this introduction. I'm just back from a long trip, 28 days, three times a year, now in July and October. The end of September, October are my 3 one-month trips. The rest of them are two and a half weeks, the other 5. But so it's kind of grueling in a way. But at one level, it was really amazing. I was in Indonesia, Myanmar, Nepal, and India. In Indonesia, the FIECI, which stands for the Fellowship of Indonesian Evangelical Churches and Institutions, which creates an interesting issue because it's the churches and the parachurch organizations, and they're the only ones of the alliances that actually mark them out that way. But the general secretary of that, after our one-day meeting, his response was, Richard Howe flies in with me to these, and Richard's the general secretary of Asia Evangelical Alliance, and Asia Evangelical Alliance is the alliance of most of the evangelical and Pentecostal churches in each of these 21 countries. So it's like a massive network. And FIECI represents 25% of all the Christians, and Richard's vision for this country is it's the base for the whole country. It matches their vision of affecting education. I don't know if you know it, but Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world. It's got like 275 million people. At any rate, his response was this was a divine meeting because they've been wrestling with the fact that they can't stabilize their churches, for one, and the churches don't have a lot of impact, and they came to the conclusion that coming up with a way to be able to educate that next generation, especially that poverty generation, was what their goal would really be, and that was completely independent of any work that we had done with them. So that was a pretty amazing start. Then I went to Nepal, NCFN, that's where Harka is. Indonesia is where Ferry is. Nepal is where Harka is, and NCFN, National Churches Fellowship of Nepal, represents a significant number of all of the churches. The church in Nepal is very young. It kind of doesn't have almost a second generation non-denominational emphasis, so it's closer in a way to the New Testament. But it happens to be that there are three other associations. The National Association, I can't remember them, but there are three other associations. But there's so much energy in what they're doing that all three of the other associations appeared at the cohort meeting and wanted to be introduced and how to be able to work with this whole process with their churches, which means it really gives us a platform for 100% of the churches in Nepal. And at a time where the government's cracking down, throwing out all the NGOs and forcing it into a true church situation. So that was pretty amazing. Then AEA, the 21 countries, is made up of alliances. Every country has an alliance, like I've been saying, but also has commissions. And they form a commission anytime that they want to take an idea and move through all the churches, move it through all the associations, all the alliances, I mean. And Richard came up with, set out another commission. The commission is church-based theological education. And then asked me to go ahead and chair the commission and gave me complete freedom to be able to put together the entire commission, all the people from the different countries, to drive everything the direction of this paradigm. And I was kind of hem-hawing around saying, well, do you want me to have a significant role? And he says, just take the thing and make it happen. So I got carte blanche to begin to work with that. Then we met with CNI, and this is the seven mainline denominations that combined together. I sat down with Richard Howell and the moderator, who's like the Pope. That, ooh, don't say that on that. We got to remember to edit that. The seven mainline denominations sat down with Richard Howell and the moderator, the Delhi bishop, and the top bishop of the Methodists, who are the only mainlines that aren't in that, at their invitation, with the view of introducing this to their churches, which is phenomenal. It wouldn't happen in the West, but only there. And Babu Rao, who a number of you know, his cohort and the cohort of the Young Future Orality Network of India we met with and continued to work with. So all this was happening, yet at times I was discouraged because it is clear to me that many leaders beyond these top ones who all have their movements, large movements, are pragmatic and often not willing to pay the serious price to get fully prepared in a disciplined manner and will pay the price of development for many future years. What I'm talking about is their commitment to really train their leaders, all the way down to their elders and deacons and leading women. They like the ideas, they're committed to them, but easily discouraged and don't have enough discipline. All have huge movements, but will they pay the price to solidify them? And at times I think not, because I know what it takes. So we show up, they haven't done their work, a few of them are thinking, oh, this is too much, I got too much practical work to do. I shared it with some of my leaders, and I can't get them to do the discipline that they need. And so one-third of them are moving ahead. One-third of them are discouraged. They're not sometimes putting in the level of work that needs to be there. And so literally I'm going around, you know, because it's a pretty exhausting thing to be doing, sometimes saying, why am I doing this? When we're all said and done, is it really going to make a difference? Well, it does. By the end of the time, they're fired up. You know, they're ready to go. But the point of this whole thing is that the work that it takes for them to get to a point where they're training multi-levels of leaders all the way down to their elders, deacons, and leading women so that they're really competent to be able to stabilize, shepherd the churches, keep them strong in the gospel, and multiplying is almost insurmountable. The illustration I used several times this time, because they have like cell ministries and saturation church planting, and these help get a bunch of churches started, but they can't stabilize them and train their leaders. I said it's like you are flying a 747, and these things taught you how to take off, and you got the thing in the air, but you don't have a clue how to fly it, and you're all circling around, you know, with each other. So that just happens to be that this morning. And I couldn't have given the message this way, and you'll see it by the end of the time. This is our last session in Thessalonians. The issue is solidifying the Thessalonians in the gospel. What exactly does this take to solidify? What exactly does this take? Does it take to solidify a new community in the gospel so that it grows to maturity and truly participates in the progress of the gospel and truly impacts its cities, meeting pressing needs and engaging in good occupations? Well, as you know, we're moving into we're moving through these early letters of Paul, which stabilizes the churches in the gospel. The first was surveying all the letters. Then we looked at Galatians, so quickly leaving the gospel. And now we look at the conversion, genuine conversion, and how to make sure that it stays solid and multiplies into strong churches. Then we'll look at the Corinthians in two different books and Romans, which is what we're moving into. Galatians was the intent of the early letters. The first book is the intent of the early letters, and then the Galatian problems, the Thessalonian conversion, the Corinthian schisms, the Romans treatise, and we surveyed all of that. The intention was to establish them strongly in the gospel. Let's see, I thought I had my slide earlier than I was looking at. There it is. So, after we've looked at, well, actually, I did need that. What am I thinking? So, in Thessalonians so far, we looked at Paul's concern for them that they stay stable and why he wrote the letter, the intention. Then you had their dramatic conversion. Then three problems emerged: immorality, laziness, and confusion over prophecy. And then we further clarified in letter two those problems, but really the title needs to, in session four, needs to be more like, he goes back to the two of the problems, and there were some people who were out of orders, out of step, and they wouldn't listen to his instructions. And so then how to deal with people that won't listen to the instructions within the church is more than a better title for that than further clarification. So our fifth session this morning then is solidifying their conversion. So it was a dramatic conversion. Now how are they going to make it stick so that it, the church matures, has impact on the progress of the gospel, and is intergenerational? So we're finishing it, conversion of the Thessalonians. So the question I want you to discuss at your table is, thinking back through the letter as a whole, and I refreshed you a little bit there, in the final analysis, what, according to Paul, did it take to solidify the Thessalonian churches in the gospel so that they fully embraced it? Now, that's a very important question, giving the illustrations large scale that I just gave you from overseas. One movement that we started working with planted 35,000 churches in about a 10-year period. By the time we got there, because they didn't answer the question of what does it mean to solidify them, they had 12,000 churches left. Now, these are all house churches that are multiplying. But we have the same problem today. How do you solidify the gospel? The CNI Church, the Church of Northern India, the seven mainline denominations, are 60 to 70% nominal today. Huge movement. The first major movement of churches in India, 60-70% nominal. In other words, the gospel is no longer there. They're a church. They're doing good things. But the gospel's gone. Evangelical churches, the AEA churches, are probably 40% nominal because they're established denominations. Even the Pentecostals denominations are probably about 20% nominal in terms of not being able to keep the gospel solid. And it's gone out of a large percentage of our churches in the U.S. today, both evangelical and Pentecostal as well, almost completely gone from mainline. So it's a very important question. We got to bring it back down to an individual church and the process, because the multiplication has to start from there. But in the final analysis, what, according to Paul, did it take to solidify the Thessalonian churches and the gospel that they embrace? How did he deal with the problems that were destabilizing them, confusing the gospel? What was the role of the local leaders in keeping them in line with the gospel and on the right course? And how are the local leaders and the Thessalonian churches to deal with those who would not keep them in line with the gospel? Now, in a way, that's session 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, and so we're summarizing in that sense, but we're focusing in on a very important piece that he weaves in and out of the whole letter, and what was his strategy in solidifying them and keeping them strong. So that's what we want to deal with this morning. So I put the one passage down there, chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians, but draw on the whole book. You can do that now, but discuss these questions, particularly the first one, in light of our study as a whole, but in light of the passage that's in front of you there. We'll take a few minutes to do that, and then I'll primarily be asking question one, and then we'll move through the end of the Thessalonian correspondence. Okay? Logic that Paul is unfolding in this letter. I don't know what Tim's on vacation or what. Josh has got it. If you got this job, you got to move fast. All right. Got it. Who wants to start? Focus on the first question. In the final analysis, what, according to Paul, did it take to solidify the Thessalonian churches? And remember, as simple as these answers are, they're profound because I just described overseas, nationally, and nationally, how entire movements lose, significant portions of movements lose in the second and third generation, the gospel itself, and the kind of establishing and lifestyle that's supposed to grow out of it. So in final analysis, what did it take to, according to Paul, what did it take to solidify them? Just give me a couple summaries. No, this is exciting. What did it take to solidify them? All right, somebody jump in. I'm going to just start calling. There's only a few people I can call on that I feel like can.
I'd say he's calling on followers to follow, leaders to lead, and to be patient and kind with each other.
Say that third one, or say one more time.
He's calling on followers to follow, leaders to lead, and to be patient and kind with each other.
Okay. That's actually a very good summary, Bob. More words than I usually get out of you at one time, but that was...
Never again.
Okay. A couple other summaries. All right, somebody, what happened at over at Jay's table. Somebody give us something out of Jay's table.
We came up with leaders lead. Basically, we said the same thing Bob did, except, you know, that whole idea is that the whole baseline out of Thessalonians is you have to become established, and you have to work hard, live a life where you're working hard, but focused on, you know, your role, what you're supposed to do, not be distracted and waiting for, you know, prophecies to be spun around and ignore all that, but just work hard. It's that idea of that, you know, the leaders have to lead, but the people have to just be living a life where they're working hard. Mm-hmm. We got into Ecclesiastes, but that sense of the reality of my life, I've got to work hard at it. I was struck by your comments this morning that, you know, that's a lot of hard work. But yeah, that's what Paul called us to, that mm-hmm. idea of working to death, that this isn't easy.
Yeah. In both the comments, leaders came up. Hand the mic over to David Cook for a second here. David, you're leading one of the churches down in Des Moines. You learned anything about what it takes to solidify?
Yeah, that idea of shepherding people and just exhorting the unruly, helping the weak, and being an encouragement, and just those kind of gravitating back and forth between those three things when you're shepherding people and trying to get them established. It's important to be able to know and assess kind of where people are at and then be able to use those as tools to help them in the establishment process.
Mm-hmm. That brings in the whole exhorting issue, again, related to leadership, the back and forth that can be there with people. That sets a good tone. Were you chasing somebody else? Okay, one more. Don?
You have to have leaders to begin with. You can't just have one big happy family. Mm-hmm. Someone needs to step forward and lead.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. Leaders are critical to this. That sets the tone a little bit. In session one in the book, or as we were laying these out, we looked at Paul's intention for writing the letter. And I'm reviewing the sessions about one or two slides each, because you've got to be able to hold the whole argument in your mind to catch the impact of what he does in 1 Thess 5. To further establish the Thessalonians, deepening them in their understanding of the full implications of the gospel they recently embraced, that they might not be unsettled, but would remain strong and focused amidst the suffering and emerging tensions in the churches. Challenging them in the first letter to fully embrace the new lifestyle as laid out in the emerging traditions handed down by Paul from Christ, and to clarify his challenges in the first letter, giving them specific instructions to solving problems that had the potential to destabilizing them. Deepening their understanding and the full implications of the gospel they had so recently and uniquely and excitedly embraced. In session two, we focused on the conversion process and how we misunderstand conversion with this easy believism, a quick response to the four laws, and don't recognize that it's a process for people to even fully understand it so they can embrace it, regardless of what specific point along the way they believe, which is true. Conversion is misunderstood because it's removed from its literary context, compartmentalized because it's separated from the establishing process, and reductionistic because it is reduced to a moment in time event only, a fire insurance and as many people as we can get to pray the sinner's prayer or to work through the four laws or whatever that is. A complete conversion process, we saw, looks at an initial solid response in which the gospel is fully embraced, takes several weeks of exposure to the Word of God, and results in those receiving the gospel beginning to proclaim it themselves. Second, it must be immediately followed up by careful nurturing and exhorting. And three, it is then followed up in the context of a new community of believers by leaders who know the Word, a balance of modality, local, and sodality, apostolic leaders. That's really what we saw in session two. In session three, we looked at the major problems that surfaced in the young Thessalonian church. The churches were only 9 months old, but they had needed to be challenged in three areas, changing their whole lifestyle from one of sexual impurity to living lives set apart for God, developing charitable concern for the whole family, learning to think of a family of families, demonstrated in their hard work and generosity, and fully embracing the gospel's charismatic claim of the return of Christ, not losing hope when loved ones die. In session four, we saw that some people, when it is clarified, even though he does clarify more on problem two and problem three, of the laziness and the confusion on prophecy, still what he really says is you're going to have to deal with the problem by dealing with the people that won't listen, that won't get in line with the teaching and are going to be stirring things up either in the leaders or of the teaching itself. He told them to hold fast to the teaching, deal with the people who will not line up with it, solve emerging problems with careful explanation, continue to clarify, and care for people by nurturing them like a nurturing mother and an exhorting, imploring father. So there's a lot of personal work in the lives of people, as well as dealing with those who are not going to line up with that teaching. Now, as we move into this last section, solidifying the conversion, let's look at Paul's whole idea of solidifying the church in the gospel. I did a chart in book three of series three of the first principles, where we were working on establishing and looking at the early letter of Paul in Thessalonians. I briefly looked back at it here, but it's developed out fully in that section. Establishing the Thessalonian community, solidifying them in the gospel, and in a way that causes that church to become strong and continue themselves to be involved in the progression of the gospel. There was first the confounding of the community and a strong conversion. We saw that took several weeks of discussion, so they really understood it, but there was a careful founding. And then the community was shaped as building on that gospel or implications of it or growing out of it. The shaping of the community is the concept of traditions, the commandments, the instructions that were given. Then the stabilizing or long-term solidifying of that or the testing of it was the challenges to the traditions of people who wouldn't follow, and of those who were trying to either bring another gospel or shake up the community in some way. And the stabilizing is directly related to the challenges that are there, which means they're always going to be there. That's part of what it means to get the roots in those initial churches. So first, Paul founded the community by proclaiming the gospel, which the Thessalonians fully embraced. Then he carefully taught them the traditions, the authoritative teaching that grew out of the gospel. Then came the challenges to that. He met the challenges in two ways. First, by writing a letter and sending Timothy. That's what chapter 3 was all about. Chapter 5 was all about. Second, by appointing leaders to solidify them in the gospel and the teaching that grows from it. Now, this is the verse that really is the hinge to understanding the long-term stability of the community or of solidifying them in the gospel. Solidifying them in the gospel doesn't just mean that they keep the gospel straight and that they don't leave it, but they understand the implications of it that demands a whole shift in our lifestyle and understanding, the centrality of being part of the community of faith in Christ's plan, and a commitment to the progression of that gospel. Not just hanging on to it and not losing it, although that's part of the picture. And I love this translation. I didn't list it here again. I forgot. It's N.T. Wright. This, my dear family, is the request we make of you. Take note, very interesting translation there, take note of those who work among you and exercise leadership over you in the Lord, those who give you instruction. Give them the highest possible rank of love because of their work. Live at peace amongst yourselves. Jay brought up the peace issue. It's going to come back up here in, a minute again, because the inability to live at peace because of major problems, minor problems, and idiosyncrasies and everything else is what begins to break up the power of the community progressing the gospel. Two very important verses. They relate to much of what it means to solidify in the gospel and the teaching that grows from it. Remember the things we've learned so far now. One is leaders need to be deeply engaged. Paul was engaged, nurturing. He was like a father and a mother to them, and nurturing them and spending a lot of time. Not only is that, did we see that that solid response was there, must be immediately followed up, and then it must be followed up in the context of a community of leaders who know the word, because it won't stick. People on their own will not just grow to maturity and multiply and progress the gospel. That's the shallowness of the modern Western discipleship movement, which is the multiplication of individuals. And remember what we saw last week, dealing with those not following the instructions of the second letter. Keep away from those not following this teaching and who, by word or letter, distort the kerygma by ignoring Paul's teaching about the return of Christ, in this particular instance, the gospel for that matter. This is a person not following Paul's authoritative teaching handed down to them from Christ. That is, he's stepping out of line. Do not treat them as an enemy, but refuse to have any dealings with them. And the word stepping out of line, which was the translation that, N.T. Wright chose, is a sense of not being in order, to break rank, a disorderly life, and not having any dealings with would be mixing it up, having conversation with, to meet, to be refreshed together, not treating him as an enemy, but things aren't just to go on as normal until that person gets in line. Now, go back to the passage. Those are the things we've been unfolding in the book. This, my dear family, is the request we make of you. Take note of those who work among you and exercise leadership over you in the Lord, those who give you instruction. Give them the highest possible rank of love because of their work. Live at peace amongst yourselves. Now, these two verses are full of really, really key words that Paul uses again and again and grows into the pastorals with. Take note. Take note literally means to understand or comprehend, to pay proper respect, to acknowledge, to give an interview with. The concept here is don't dismiss them. Take note. If it's leaders that are stepping in to a situation, don't dismiss them. Don't say, why are they doing what they're doing? There must be some kind of problem. I never trusted them anyway. The idea is take time, give proper respect, and seek to comprehend what was done, and don't dismiss them. The second, those who work among you. This is a very strong word. It's to toil, labor, to become tired. One literal translation is to trouble oneself. You know, in other words, if the guys that agreed to be senior elders say, I'm going to do that, they've troubled themselves. They're going to have all kinds of problems because of that. I use David again. It's his first round at leading a church or shepherding a church. Would you say that you've troubled yourself? Your life would be a lot cleaner. It would be a lot simpler without taking on that kind of responsibility. To become discouraged, to wear oneself out, to give up. Anybody that's going to assume the responsibility of keeping a church and people on course and all the opposition that Satan's going to bring and the difficulty that we all have of just growing and maturing is going to wear themselves out because they're not going to be successful if they don't commit to that kind of level. Great terms. Exercise leadership over. This is a strong word. To be at the head, to lead, to direct, to rule, to manage, to care for. This is the term that Paul uses for if you can't manage your own household well, how can you manage the church of God? It's a strong word that he uses for leadership in the pastorals, for elders, for deacons who assist, and women who assist in that whole process. Who give you instruction. This is the word, not just general instruction, but to admonish, to put in mind, to rebuke, to advise concerning. Those who have the ability to handle the unruly. Give them the highest possible rank of love. It's to regard or esteem very highly, superabundantly, as earnestly as possible. Because of their work, this is a different word for work. This work is for their workmanship, their undertaking, the occupation, the role they've assumed within that. And finally, live at peace. Leadership is key to being at peace within the churches. Now, what does this all add up to? One is, don't dismiss leaders. Acknowledge them and seek to clearly understand why they're doing what they're doing and respect them. Second, recognize the work they are doing will bring trouble on them. They will become tired, discouraged, and often want to give up. Three, there are leaders who are appointed to lead churches, elders, deacons, and leading women. These are real positions and expected to be honored. And one of the main jobs is to correct, confront, rebuke, and to give strong advice. Five, regard and esteem them highly because of the task or occupation they've undertaken. Six, their role is key to living peacefully in community, as the community life includes living with each other in a unified manner, recognizing that we need to be patient with each other, from major demands to our problems and differences and perfections. Now, you're going to see at the end, this applies to everybody in this room, because this is really the core of our leadership, of our key strong families, our key strong singles that regularly meet on Sunday morning. That's how we set it up. And if churches are going to multiply and they're going to be small, authentic communities, then this applies to leaders, but it also applies to everybody else that should be expecting to grow to leadership at one level or another in that context. Now, remember what the shepherding involves. 1 Thess 5:12-13 is followed by 1 Thess 5:14 that we looked at in depth earlier. And my dear family, he goes on, we beg you to warn those who step out of line, console the downcast, help the weak, and be warm-hearted and patient towards everybody. Now, three categories, and again, I'm using N.T. Wright's translation here because it's fresh. Three categories of assistance are needed to stabilize churches in the gospel and the teaching which builds on it. Warn those who step out of line, console the downcast, and help the weak. The three categories of assistance needed to stabilize the churches in the gospel and build on it. Warn those who step out of line. Warn means to put in mind, to sharply rebuke. Console the downcast is parakaleo, to come alongside, to call alongside and put your arm around somebody that's downcast, has evidently had something that's kicked the life out of them. Help the weak means to be a support system to those without inner resources. The Greek word there is asthenic. That's a person who is weak and without a lot of resources, and sometimes that may be lifelong and can relate to the life rebuilding. I'm going to skip this part. I don't really need this to review this right now. What does that look like, to admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak? Okay, if you look at the fact, this pastoral care taxonomy, there's the conversion process, the establishing process, and then somebody becomes, let's see, this has dots on it, doesn't it? Yeah, the conversion process, the establishing process, and becoming a productive member of community. Special assistance might need to be there, especially for the asthenic all the way through. And so this is a process that everybody should be come in getting established in their faith. And a lot of times the step out of line person is a person who won't align themselves with that teaching. Strongholds is the person who is downcast. Console the downcast, it said. That's somebody who has something has kicked the life out of them, some problem, something that now has got a hold of them. It could even be the death of somebody in the family. Life rebuilding, particularly, is that asthenic, the weak that need infrastructure underneath. Now, again, I'm generalizing here a bit, but my question is, if you're taking on responsibility, whether it's an individual church and you're an elder, deacon, or leading woman assisting in that, or whether you're in our senior eldership, or whether you're on our apostolic team, which brings a lot of responsibility with it, this is not easy. You take a group of just 12 adults in a small house church and stay with this so that it's established and multiplying, you're bringing trouble on yourself. That's really what it says if you assume that responsibility. We shouldn't expect anything else. Our whole life rebuilding program, we've just gotten into the life rebuilding stuff, and already it's easy to recognize that 4 or 5 families into that, you begin to recognize this is huge. It may not work. This is far more work than I thought it was going to be. Feel that way, John, at all? You know? We're bringing trouble on ourselves. This is really cool stuff. So, solidifying churches in the gospel, if we turn around and ask it from an issue standpoint, in final analysis, what does it take to fully establish believers in the gospel and the accompanying lifestyle? How should we deal with problems that are destabilizing the church? What is the role of leaders in keeping the churches in line with the gospel and on the right course? And how were local leaders to lead those who would not stay in line with the gospel? The kind of work that it takes is not expected of leadership in our Christian churches today. And it's a whole new ball game overseas. Recognizing that some of these guys have movements, they have no tiered leadership, they have no apostolic teams, they don't have a concept of well-trained senior eldership, let alone the qualification that needs to be there in every small house church. And you begin to see the nature of the work and problems that are at hand. And if we do lead like this and expect the communities to grow and stabilize in one-mindedness, then there's a whole set of criticism that goes with it because that's not what's normally expected in the kind of society that we live in. We've developed a system for leaders and believers to follow, which is almost identical with the process of the early church. That is why they were the way they were established, rooted in the formation of the New Testament as a body of teaching delivered by the apostles. And I'm not going to review that in any kind of detail this morning, but the reality is we have built a system for taking people through a process of getting them established in the kerygma and building on a Pauline theology of the kerygma, the sound doctrine, the early, middle, later letters, and then getting them fully established in the Gospels and finally in Peter and Paul's letters. So taking things like the story, the first principles, the Gospels, and when we're finished with this, the early letters of Paul are all in that foundational establishing. And we all need to be competent as leaders for the things that Paul is talking about in Thessalonians to take place. Now, why do you need to understand this in depth? Well, the early letters that we're on now are tools for establishing churches fully in the gospel. Leaders need this to fully establish and guard churches, and there's power in everyone knowing these letters with confidence and being able to use them. Now, a special note to leaders as we finish Thessalonians. Expect to be tired, weary, discouraged, and feel like giving up often. It's what you signed up for. 2, you better be well prepared and continually developing. 3, our churches will not be solidified in the gospel and high impact unless we're up to the task. And this is a tireless job that we are to do. This is a tireless job that we are to do until we pass it on. So not only did you sign up for it, but it's not a 3-year assignment. There's going to come a time where you're going to pass it on, just like Paul did to Timothy, but it's like a lifetime headache. Now, special note to serious, maturing believers and families in the churches. This is the rest of the people in the room. Honor leaders, trust them, acknowledge the importance of their role, and seek to understand why they are shaping churches and solving problems the way they are. Help each other in this process. Become fully stable in the gospel yourself and your family, and expect to be in leadership in the future in some form if you want to see the gospel progress through the multiplication of these churches. It's not rocket science, but it's tough stuff. And it demands the careful working of people and ultimately being completely patient with each other, because there's nobody that's not in the development process. I think that's the end. Yeah, no, back to this. Okay, now back to the trip that I was on. Exciting, people get it, yet the reality is it means training their leaders all the way down to elders and deacons and leading women. They like the ideas and are committed to them, but easily discouraged and don't have enough discipline. All have huge movements, but will they pay the price to solidify them? At times, I think not, because I know what it takes. And that's kind of a special word to all of us, but to those of us that have the privilege, but the burden, of moving in and out amongst these movements. You know, getting them to do their five-year plans, doing all of the follow-up and work, and the headache that it is, and showing up, and two-thirds of them haven't done it, and one-third of them have an excuse for not being there. But staying with that, and bringing them to the point of developing the competencies and the conviction is also part of our labor. And it's lifelong as well. Really, really simple, really clear stuff. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the labor of love that we see in the Apostle Paul. And all the stuff he put up with in his day and age, everywhere from beatings to sleepless nights, and the level of work that he put in, you know, with leadership, and the challenge for people to take up that responsibility at every level, all given in just this simple, short letter that we can read almost at the time we read an introduction to a book. I pray that as we move through these letters and we get into deeper water, when we move in now to 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians and Romans, that we would have a very good grasp of what our responsibilities are and perspective as leaders and people that are hosting churches and helping assist churches in our homes. And that we would stay with that over the long haul, develop the competency that we need to be able to help people, and stay with aligning ourselves with that kerygma and didache. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.